Good morning. It's wonderful, as always, to see your faces for those who have their cameras on. So, today we're discussing Parsha Emor in the book of Leviticus. And our challenge is that Leviticus appears to be a long list of rules for the priesthood without a coherent narrative that kind of bring it to life. But is there a way that this apparent list of rules can become a meaningful story that reflects something in our own personal narrative or struggle? So as I reflected on this week's Parsha, I came to see, at least for this moment, and with the help of our wonderful Torah scholars, that this book of rules could reflect our struggle to sustain connection with something that's invisible, not able to be described in words, but also seems essential to many of us for dealing with the confusion and distress of life and death, of suffering and peace. So I hope that through our discussion today, we can find some reflection of our own struggle in this text. So fortunately, Aviva Zornberg reflects on her discovery of what she calls the hidden narrative of the Book of Leviticus. In her book, The Order of Intimacy, she points out how certain words and images appear again and again in Leviticus, pointing back in time to the rupture of the relationship between God and the Israelites. That rupture is the golden calf episode. So prior to this rupture, the children of Israel had made a commitment, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will listen. And God tells Moses, let them build me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. This is a promise of God living in their very midst. It's a promise of intimacy. But even as the Israelites are building the sanctuary, we are told a story of what may have happened before in time, during, or after, but it's a narrative of a people who were too frightened, too impatient, and too much in need of a concrete object of worship to experience God dwelling in their midst when Moses was absent. They demand that Aaron make them a visible, solid God, and Aaron complies, calling on everyone to donate their gold to make this God. Of course, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh experiences this as an act of betrayal, and Zornberg refers to a commentary that sees parallels in a story of a bride who, even at her wedding ceremony with the king, is lusting after someone other than the king. The parable of this story highlights the sense of betrayal, of moral failure, and the people's longing for a more concrete God, a different God than the one to whom they have just been metaphorically wed. And the path to repairing this rupture is the project of building the Mishkan and carrying out the rituals of the Mishkan just so. Zornberg points out if the Mishkan could be properly completed and all the rituals properly followed, then God's presence in the Mishkan would be a sign of forgiveness. She explains the Mishkan does not merely represent forgiveness, it becomes a therapeutic device for healing the national disorder that is called the golden calf. So we have to pause here to appreciate the resonance of this theme of a national disorder, as it resonates with our current times, I think, whether here or in Israel, there's a sense of a disorder that is both discouraging, but calling it a disorder is somewhat hopeful in the sense that it's a problem for which there could be a diagnosis, a treatment plan, and hope for recovery. Of course, that is how many describe the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, which are a diagnosis of having suffering in life, the cause of suffering, the prognosis that we can move beyond suffering, and the treatment plan, which is the Eightfold Path. And I don't know that this can be turned in any practical way into a treatment plan for national disorder, but they certainly lead, these Four Noble Truths do lead to a personal treatment plan for ending our fight with reality, a fight we can never win. So back to the Mishkan. Zornberg highlights a recurrent theme. Let the gold of the Mishkan atone for the gold they brought toward making the golden calf. So all the meticulous and painstaking work of the gold fixtures of the Mishkan is a repair for the rupture with God that was caused by this very impulsive creation of the golden calf. The Mishkan is the divine therapeutic response to the golden calf. Now, handiwork, crafts, it's therapeutic on many levels. This particular handiwork is with the same material, gold, that was impulsively thrown onto the fire. It seemed to just, as Aaron said, the calf leaped out of the fire. And that same material, gold, is now being crafted according to specific directions dictated by God with a lot of oversight and care. So this could certainly, the kind of care and the craftsmanship could certainly be seen as a work of repentance. And when we discussed this in Torah study, one class member said, "Isn't it interesting that after the Exodus, the first thing that God tells the people to do is an art project?" Her comment reflects another layer of what's therapeutic about art. After a traumatic experience, art is one of the ways people address their grief and hurt, not just through the subject, the content of the work that might reflect processing of the trauma, but also through the act of it, through the rhythmic, repetitive, and soothing movements of painting or drawing or sculpting. And if a whole community engages in this process together, it can be part of a healing of a community disorder. And a few weeks ago, I took part in a TBC experience to prepare for the Mother's Day Walk for Peace that's sponsored by the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute, which provides a range of opportunities for healing for families who have lost loved ones to violence in Massachusetts, and also supports for returning citizens. The Peace Institute has an artist in residence, Ruth Henry, and we were fortunate that she came to TBC to facilitate our community art project of decorating our banner that we carried during the walk on Mother's Day this past weekend. And that kind of rhythmic activity of coloring together, followed by the activity of walking together in community, offered two different aspects of embodied prayer and recovery. So back to the Mishkan again, which becomes the sacred space in which the priests carry out rituals. So all the rituals for the priesthood that maintain the functioning of the Mishkan are similarly part of this rehab program. The rituals are exactly what you have to do if you want God to dwell among you, and if you want the experience of closeness to God after this misguided attempt to embrace the golden calf. And this interpretation has a therapeutic, reparative momentum that's suddenly disrupted for many of us when our modern sensibility reads about the rules for which priests can make offering to God. Because in this week's Torah reading, Amor, God tells God, speak to Aaron and say, no man of your offspring throughout the ages who has a defect shall be qualified to offer the food of his God. No one who's blind or lame or has a limb too short or too long, and there's a list of all the things that would disqualify a priest from being able to offer, to give the offering. And when we read this, we may wonder, is God casting a Hollywood production or a sacred ritual practice? We may ask, why isn't God requiring that somebody be genuine and compassionate, kind, honest, loving? Much commentary has been written, and I'll summarize an aspect of it that aligns with the theme of needing to repair after the golden calf. So on a concrete level, the perfection of the human body, or the desire for perfection, can be seen as parallel to the beauty of the Mishkan. Just like the Mishkan must be built exactly to specification, so too the bodies that offer sacrifice as part of this practice must be beautiful, retaining the original blueprint that God developed for the human body, which of course is imperfect anyway. And also, we're told not to bring God sick or dying animals that we kind of need to get rid of anyway. We bring offerings of the most perfect specimens of livestock. But this explanation is not very satisfying, because surely the God character in this story should be able to recognize and appreciate a truly compassionate, devout person who just happens to limp or have an injury or an infection. However, there is an argument that the people at their level of devotion and struggle with devotion to an invisible presence, that the people would be somehow frightened or preoccupied if priests offering sacrifices were limping, injured, or disabled. So the rules about perfection of appearance have been interpreted as a concession to the people's concrete style of thinking, their immature level of spiritual development, their inability to look past surface appearance to the wholeness and perfection of a person's being. Similarly, the instruction to build the Mishkan was, according to some, a concession to the people's need for concrete structure within which to worship Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. This interpretation and related commentary is summarized in an article that was in Lehrerhaus, an online journal, by Joseph Stadlin, and he refers to Zornberg's interpretation that these disqualifications are concessions to anti-disability prejudices as much as the entire Mishkan project is, according to the biblical commentator Sforno, a concession to the need for concrete representation so disastrously manifested in the Golden Calf episode. So Stadlin, in this article called Priests and Prejudice, he reviews commentaries that refer to times before the Golden Calf, before the Mishkan, when lay people made offerings on their private altars, where anyone with or without imperfection could offer a sacrifice, any firstborn, actually. So until the tabernacle was established, private altars were permitted, the sacrificial service was performed by the firstborn. And from the time that the tabernacle was established, private altars were prohibited, and the sacrificial service was performed by priests. Not to forget, of course, that God chose Moses, someone with a speech disability, to communicate the intention of God. Stadlin writes, God could have offered to cure Moses if God agreed with Moses that his speech disability was a barrier to effective leadership, a possibility that Ibn Ezra raises and clarifies that this is not the path that God takes. God did not promise Moses, when Moses said, I can't do this, I'm slow of speech, God did not promise Moses that he would cure him of his slowness of tongue. He only promised to teach him what to speak. And God offers social support. I will be with you as you speak and will instruct you what to say. And God wants to partner with Moses despite this difficulty speaking. But of course, for Moses, God's support is not enough to convince Moses to accept the job. And so God suggests that Moses turn to support from family and community, and specifically his brother Aaron, since he is someone who speaks readily. So according to Sforno's commentary, before the sin of the golden calf, God had promised in Exodus early on, make for me an altar of earth and sacrifice, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your sacrifices of well-being, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I cause my name to be mentioned, I will come to you and bless you. So this was every place, not just the Mishkan. And after the golden calf, God could not be walking in their midst. God pulled back and agreed to be present in the sanctuary only once it was perfectly built and all the rules were followed. So according to this interpretation, Stadlin leads us to understand that God responds to the golden calf as a sign that the people were not yet able to experience intimate connection with an invisible, ineffable God. So the changes that came after the golden calf were these adaptations to where the people seemed to be in their ability to practice. That instead of allowing people to willy-nilly replace the invisible God with a golden calf, God withdraws from the people and reorients their love of gold to a physical home for God, the Mishkan. And instead of allowing the people to get rid of Moses, he allows Moses' brother to serve in the ritual role, and Aaron's descendants that Aaron had already taken on in the golden calf episode of leading with the sacrificial services. And in this way, we understand that Aaron is appointed not despite his involvement with the golden calf, but because of it. And also, God concedes to the people's need for something concrete in their worship and something visibly appealing in their worship, and has these rules of the for the priesthood. So we're left with this question: how do these themes resonate with our own relationship with Yud Hey Vav Hey? What is the meaning for you of having a temple that is beautifully appointed as a place to reconnect with our spiritual practice? Does it help you to walk into the sanctuary and have that feeling that this is a place where so many before you have come to renew their connection with Yod Heh Vav Heh? As Jews, we don't have altars at home, but we do have special ritual objects for Shabbat. And as people who practice meditation, we may have a cushion at home, and if we're fortunate to have the space, we may have like a corner of the room or a space that's dedicated for only meditation. So I'm interested in hearing what kinds of perfection or beauty are actually important to us in our practice. And also, what keeps us from appreciating the perfection of all creation? So let's take a moment of silence after lots of words.